The religious studies scholar Christina Rossetti tracks people on the fringes of Mormonism. Some get way out there. They leave and start their own church. Others just don't agree with certain positions church leaders have taken over the years, and they sit with it, at least at first. She noticed this once the pandemic took hold, how some conservative members had political disagreements with church policies on masks and recommendations to get vaccinated. Rossetti says some began questioning their membership, and others saw the policies as a kind of confirmation that their leaders had gone astray. She says this is what happened to Phil Davis.
Phil Davis is a, to my knowledge, current active member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He's a chocolatier. He was the head chocolatier of Taste in Provo, which I don't know if you've been there, but it's like really popular because it's just like chocolate tasting, hot chocolate, you know, things like that. Now he is the head chocolatier of another chocolate like subscription service. I don't know what the language for the chocolate industry is. Anyway, he received a visitation from angels, you know, tale as old as time. And he was told...
Wait. He's a chocolatier and he received a visitation from angels. That's a big deal.
I mean, yes and no. Like I said, tale as old as time. Like, this is a story that Mormon men have been participating in for generations of people receiving revelations. And then all of a sudden they have some kind of special knowledge and become a charismatic leader. But with him, he receives a angelic visitation and he is instructed that there will be a preparatory period for the return of Joseph Smith, who will set the house of God in order. That might sound strange or bizarre, but that's also something that's, you know, incredibly common in the history of Mormonism. And he's kind of this like special figure that the church is corrupted. There's a problem within the institution, and he's able to offer a way of doing Mormonism that is more pure and more righteous and more in line with what God would like the church to do on earth.
So you mentioned that this movement that he started isn't large, but you say it's one of just the latest expressions of Mormonism that speaks to this context we find ourselves in. What do you mean by that? What is the context we find ourselves in? How does Phil Davis fit into this moment?
There's a bigger history of dissatisfaction with the institutional church. We hear this from people who are both conservative, liberal, whatever. And a lot of these same people who are already dissatisfied with the LDS church spiritually are now seeing the LDS church doesn't comport with their political or social values either. And COVID, I think, really exacerbated that. And within this context of people who are kind of spiritually disenfranchised with the church, but also are now seeing the church completely disaligned with what they believe to be correct about the world, this guy comes in with this movement that says you can have like individualized Mormonism, you can have these spiritual experiences, and also the LDS church is corrupt. You're not wrong when you believe that. I think that's really compelling to people. The church responded, I think, to the pandemic in a way that I was surprised by, in terms of how quickly they closed the temples, how quickly they supported the vaccine, putting the vaccine in the general handbook of instruction, and then President Nelson, you know, very publicly getting the vaccine. I think one of the components of Mormonism that we kind of brush over when we think of these new groups that start is that the same priesthood that Phil Davis has is the same priesthood that Russell M. Nelson has. Yes, one has more like keys or ability to exercise priesthood, but they have the same priesthood in them according to their ideas. So it stands to reason that any man could technically be the leader of Mormonism if they wanted to be or if they were called to be. And Phil Davis is no different. So this idea of someone receiving some angelic visitation saying you're the prophet now is not new. And it often comes with people who are dissatisfied generally with what the church is doing. So for someone who's so dissatisfied with the way the church is temporally operating, who also believes that they're fully capable of running this religion the same way, if not better, than President Nelson, that's a possibility. I don't see it as shocking in any way.
Christina Rossetti is a visiting assistant professor of religious studies at Claremont McKenna College. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Now, it's important to remember that Phil Davis is an extreme example. Not all conservatives who don't like the church's position on vaccines are thinking about leaving, but they have found themselves in a similar position with LDS progressives, not quite in line with the leadership and not sure what to do about it. In a recent article for the Washington Post magazine, the reporter Emily Kaplan writes about this moment for Mormonism. She describes it as an inflection point for the faith.
In my reporting, I found that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints seems to be at a moment in time in which they're struggling to cohere, to satisfy Latter-day Saints who are discontented both from the right and from the left. So historically, this has been a place that a lot of liberal Latter-day Saints have found themselves in, where they find themselves wishing that the church would make changes or would be more liberal in many ways, and conservatives, not so much. Yeah. But, you know, with the First Presidency's statement on masks over the summer, it seems like the community of American Latter-day Saints is in a position where it hasn't been before, which is conservative members for the first time are finding themselves in tension with statements made by the prophet and the First Presidency. And this isn't to say, of course, that all conservative Latter-day Saints disagree with the statement on vaccines and masks. Of course, that isn't true. But those who do disagree with the statement tend to be on the right or even the far right politically in this country. And, you know, you have liberal Latter-day Saints being basically like, well, welcome to the club.
You know,
we've we've been unhappy with the church's stance on all sorts of things for 50 plus years, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Now you know how we feel.
So there's facing, as you say, that similar kind of cognitive dissonance that liberals have been contending with for decades. And when one of your sources
right.
put it, one of the questions that conservatives are asking themselves these days is who they trust more, the as this person put it, the prophet or Tucker Carlson. Explain
right.
what they meant by that.
The question of who to seek guidance from has always been fraught for liberal Latter-day Saints, because their religious authorities are sometimes in tension with secular authorities. And now, maybe for the first time, conservative Latter-day Saints are facing a similar phenomenon. Lisa Mosman, who is a liberal Latter-day Saint in Orem, Utah, who I spoke to for the piece, said that a lot of her neighbors are questioning, you know, as she put it, who they trust more, the prophet or Tucker Carlson, on the question of vaccines and mask wearing. And it really comes down to a question of who the authority figures are in people's lives and who they can trust for guidance. And when you have secular authorities in tension with religious authorities, that causes a lot of tension for a lot of people.
One of the questions you raise in the article is whether or not this is just a feature of modern American culture. I mean, the kind of thing that is happening in, you know, American culture more broadly. And you spoke with the scholar of Mormonism, Kathleen Flake, and she made this case that there's this lack of confidence among people about where to find the truth. Explain what she was saying there.
Right. And really, whether there is truth at all.
Right.
You know, whether there is an authority to look to at all. You know, we're in a time, as she really brilliantly put it, in American history in which people are doubting whether there are authority figures to turn to. And I think that is being expressed in Mormonism. And I think Mormonism has always been a uniquely distilled and helpful way to understand broader societal trends. And I think that this is just one more example of that in our current moment.
So let's talk about the experience of liberals in the faith, which you also explore. You mentioned how the church is struggling with how much and whether to accommodate liberals. And that's led to, as you talk about in the article, this internal division. Explain what you mean there.
Yeah, I don't want to put it that it's the question of whether to accommodate liberals. I think the way I think about it is the question of whether there are many ways to be a Latter-day Saint.
Right.
And I think it's a question of how to deal with dissent or the ability to express one's religious beliefs and political beliefs and ideologies in different ways. So whether it's possible, for instance, to say, I am a Latter-day Saint, and I also believe that homosexuality is something that is no different than heterosexuality in terms of how God sees it, or in terms of, you know, entry to the celestial kingdom, for instance. These questions that the church has taken a stance on and people refuse to accept, frankly. Mm. And so I think the question is, are there many ways of being a Latter-day Saint?
Right.
And I think one of the things that make this religion unique is that there is a very powerful central authority that really doesn't exist in any other faith, even Catholicism. And this institution is extremely involved in the minutia of people's lives and beliefs. There is no other faith that I am aware of in which members routinely are interviewed by clergy about their actions, their lives, to some extent, their beliefs. And that has all sorts of theological consequences. So, you know, the church has a lot of control and presence in people's lives in a way that makes it difficult for people to express their Latter-day Saint identity in ways that don't necessarily conform to what the institution is saying is the way to be a Latter-day Saint.
Yeah. And let's talk about how you explore that in the piece. Let's talk about your experience in Berkeley. Which is, I think, for those who may be familiar with Latter-day Saint culture, may have gone to, you know, Latter-day Saint ward houses, the experience in Berkeley is going to be very different from an experience of going to a ward house in Provo or Bountiful, Utah, suburb of Salt Lake City. Talk about what you found there, if you would.
Sure. So, you know, my reporting was so interesting. I mean, I love all my reporting trips, but I must say this was one of my favorites. It was so wonderful and interesting, and I met so many interesting, generous, kind, committed people. So I had gone directly from Rexburg, Idaho, which is extremely conservative, socially, politically, and religiously, to Berkeley, California, which is the opposite of that in every conceivable way.
Right.
You know, I was really struck when I went to the family ward in Berkeley. I knew I was very much, you know, in the mission field. It was across the street from the First Pete's Coffee in the Bay Area. And on one side and then on the other side, it was across the street from a Quaker Friends Seminary. So it felt very, very Berkeley in that way. And, you know, I had just had an experience in Rexburg going to Sunday services there. And that conforms, I think, more to what a lot of non-Latter-day Saints think of when they think of Latter-day Saint culture.
Yeah. White shirts, you know, and ties. And
exactly. Yeah. Long dresses. It was very orderly. And Berkeley, California was the complete opposite.
Yeah.
I counted, I think, at least 10 women wearing pants, Birkenstocks, tank tops, men wore beards, you know, all these things that are culturally not the norm in Latter-day Saint culture, especially, you know, in church services.
Yeah.
So the newly elected president of the Elders Quorum had shoulder length hair, and he referenced Back to the Future as gospel. He used the word gospel in referring to it. It was just, it was very, very colorful and very individualist. It certainly did not conform to what many outsiders, myself included, would have necessarily thought would be a Latter-day Saint religious service.
Yeah.
It was also racially very diverse.
Emily Kaplan, her cover story in the Washington Post magazine is called The Rise of the Liberal Latter-day Saints. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER is proud to be a listener-supported public radio station. We'd like to thank our community of more than 10,000 sustainers who make a monthly contribution to the station, starting at just $5 a month. Because of your support, all the news, stories, and conversations that you hear are independent, calm, and commercial-free. If something you heard on KUER made a difference to you recently, become a new sustainer or increase your existing pledge at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a recent article in the Washington Post magazine by the reporter Emily Kaplan. The article explores the rise of liberalism within Mormonism and how some progressives are decoupling theology from culture. They still call themselves Latter-day Saints. They're just not quite in line with every bit of church doctrine. And according to Kaplan, the same thing could be happening to conservatives. One of the unique insights in the article is her exploration of how personal revelation fits in this story. For Latter-day Saints, this is a somewhat unique feature of the faith. Personal revelation is like prayer, but it's different. It's kind of this license to go past or around religious authorities and get to God directly for very particular guidance. And Kaplan has found that members who don't agree with leadership, whether it's about gay rights or getting a COVID vaccination, they're using personal revelation to get an answer to prayer that better aligns with their ideals. Back to our conversation. It seems like one of the key observations that we need to talk about in the article is the role of personal revelation in the success of Latter-day Saints and how it also might be driving this conflict, at least internal conflict, of liberals and conservatives. So let's explain what it is, first of all. How is personal revelation explained to you for Latter-day Saints, how that might be a uniquely distinct feature of Mormonism?
Personal revelation was described to me as the ability for any sort of rank and file Latter-day Saint. So a Latter-day Saint who isn't a religious authority and who isn't a leader can speak directly with God and to receive counsel pertaining to his or her own life. That's in contrast to prophetic revelation, in which, you know, the prophet receives revelation on behalf of all Latter-day Saints. But, you know, I observed, as I spoke with many, many Latter-day Saints, including many who are struggling to reconcile their sexuality with their faith, that it was used as a way to reconcile sources of tension. So a lot of the openly gay Latter-day Saints who I spoke to said that they had received personal revelation that they could have a same-sex relationship, and that God approved of that, and that was part of their own personal plan. And, you know, that is not something that some religious authority said is possible. You know, some religious authorities told me, well, that person misunderstands either what God said to them or what is possible for an individual to receive in terms of personal revelation. So, you know, I think the ability to understand even what personal revelation is and what it can apply to is not necessarily universally shared,
right. It seems like the sense of personal revelation then, it allows what's interesting about the piece is it allows not just liberals but also conservatives, possibly anyway, to develop these beliefs independent of the inclinations of church leaders. And the example you mentioned in Rexburg of people using personal revelation to kind of sidestep their leaders is this scene you lay out in Rexburg with the gay men there trying to reconcile their faith with their sexuality. Tell us a little bit about Jason Holcomb, because he sort of personifies all of this.
Jason Holcomb is a young man. He's 24. He's a recent graduate of BYU, Idaho, and he just came out as gay. He actually used the article as the way to come out to everyone in his life, and it went extraordinarily well. He was universally embraced by everyone in his life, including all of his family. So that was really, really wonderful to see for him because it made him really, really happy. And, you know, he grew up a devout Latter-day Saint. He went on a mission and he married a woman, even though he knew he was gay. And he told me that he received personal revelation from God that it was okay for him to be gay. I heard the same thing from Jackson Taylor, who's another young man who grew up in Idaho Falls, now is a sophomore at UC Berkeley. and is openly gay. He said the same thing, that God told him that God's plan for him was to be gay, and that's okay. And it would not prevent him from entering the celestial kingdom or other things that he wants, or, you know, having an eternal family, all the things that he wants for himself. Mm-hmm. So way to be a Latter-day Saint and be who he believes is, you know, his true self. Yeah. So a lot of the young gay men that I spoke to spoke that way.
So personal revelation allows them a kind of a workaround, or at least as they see it, or a way to sidestep.
Well, they don't say it that
way.
No,
they do not. Yeah, absolutely. No, that's kind of a crass way of putting it. And it's probably not the right way to put it. But it does give them a kind of independence. And I guess the question is, does it work for conservatives too? Those who may have ideas that are not in line with church leader stances on vaccines or masking or, you know, conspiracy theories or prepping. Do you think the same kind of thing is happening for conservatives, where they're having their own kind of personal revelation that doesn't match necessary leaders, but they think God is telling them that it's okay?
You know, I have seen that. That was not within the purview of my reporting, but in the months since I did the reporting and since my piece came out, I have seen a lot of that, especially on Twitter, especially in response to First Presidency statement on masks and vaccines, is that a lot of people said, well, God told me that I should not get vaccinated. That's my personal revelation. And that puts them in conflict in the same way, you know, that their liberal co-religionists have been experiencing for decades, as I said earlier.
Yeah. One of the questions you raise in the article is, what is the best way to get church leaders or the church itself to change? And you speak with a former LDS stake president, a man named Dean Criddle, and he talked about how if you want the church to change, you have to use what he described, or maybe you described it, as the levers of the institution. You can't go around publicly criticizing leaders if you're going to change. You have to use the institution itself. Say a little bit about that part of the article, if you would.
Yeah, that is something that I'm very interested in. And I also I want to share an anecdote from that reporting that didn't make it into the article, but I think is very relevant here, which is Dean Criddle, when he was Oakland State President, held a forum for a visiting apostle after the church's statement on Prop 8. Which was, so in 2008, the church put out a statement that Latter-day Saints should quote, do all that they could do to pass Proposition 8 in California, which would have limited marriage to between a man and a woman. Right. And this was incredibly hurtful to many, many Latter-day Saints in the Bay Area and elsewhere, but particularly in the Bay Area, which is so politically liberal. And he hosted a forum in which the visiting apostle could hear from people who had been really wounded by this statement. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of literature put out about this forum that were talked about. And there were songs sung and there were poems recited and scripture quoted, mm-hmm. lots of things to emphasize the point that a lot of people were very deeply wounded by the church's actions. And I read all of the material that was published as part of this event. And one of the things that I was very struck by was a song called "I'll Walk With You." The lyrics were really striking to me because, you know, if you've been hurt, if you've been, if you felt attacked, if you feel alone, I'll walk with you. And that was the refrain of the song, "I'll Walk With You." And I asked Dean Criddle, I said, something I was really struck by in the song was that the focus is on the consequences of the actions. You know, if you feel hurt, if you feel rejected, et cetera, I'll walk with you, I'll accompany you, I'll be there for you. But it's not about the need to, you know, change the reason why these hurts are being done in the first place. Yeah. You know, it's not like I will try to make structural change to make sure that this never happens again. Mm. It was more about the after effects. And he said, you're absolutely right. He said, that is exactly what we were trying to do. And I was really struck by that. So, you know, the emphasis on attending to the hurt of people, but not fundamentally changing the institution or even asking for change.
I have to say, it's a question that has confounded a lot of us who cover Mormonism, and something sounds like you're encountering right now. And it's this big question of why it is church leaders are unwilling to change, but not only that, unwilling to apologize when they, you know, shift gears from time to time. What are you finding about that as you've started to cover this?
Right. I mean, I've certainly heard the phrase, the church does not apologize. Yeah. A lot of people have repeated that phrase in hurt. You know, they've said, I've been so hurt by my leaders, by my faith, and I know that they're not going to apologize because of the phrase, the church does not apologize, which I know has been spoken by President Oakes and others, but that is often attributed to him. My reporting has shown that it's very, very painful for a lot of people who feel rejected by the church. Again, I mean, not being a Latter-day Saint, but certainly not being, you know, a Latter-day Saint leader, I don't know, you know, what the thinking is behind that approach. I must say it's confounding to me as well sometimes. Yeah. And I know it's caused a lot of pain. I do wonder whether it could lead to real problems within the institution, within the community, whether, you know, already something that we haven't spoken about so far, which I think is important to talk about, is the role of the youngest members, yeah, millennials and now Gen Z Latter-day Saints who are leaving. Right. And, you know, a lot of them are leaving because they don't want to be part of an institution that they see as unwilling to atone for its mistakes or to correct them. So I think that, you know, it's certainly been the stance historically that the church does not apologize. I think that that could spell trouble for them in the future. And I think in many ways it already is.
You know, one of the things your article raises, though, and this is which is, I think, kind of unique in the conversation that we usually have about these things, is that now you're having to take – so there's always been a liberal segment that is pushing for change. They want the church to be more progressive. But in your article, you introduced this idea, this kind of new form of maybe dissidence is a strong word, but a new segment of outspoken conservatives. And so the question is, when you're talking about change, you have to wonder, change in what direction? You right. know, do they become more socially progressive church leaders, or do they mm-hmm. become even more conservative to accommodate that other wing? Because they're getting pulled or pushed, it seems, from both directions.
Right. And I think the question is whether a global community that is so internally diverse mm-hmm. in so many ways mm-hmm. can cohere,
right.
can continue on with a model that is so tightly controlled from the top. And frankly, from the top that is controlled by almost entirely white men in their 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
I think that is the question for the church right now.
You said this earlier, Mormonism has always been an extremely centralized faith. Leaders mm-hmm. and members talk about how important it is to have, you know, the proper authority to act, how following the guidance of leaders is important. But this idea, when you now introduce a kind of liberal use, you know, small l liberal use of personal revelation, it seems like there's this kind of trend, I wonder, about those sort of untethering themselves from
right.
from the centralized idea of the church. Are you finding that to some degree?
I certainly am. And the other thing that I'm finding that I'm very interested in is the decoupling of Latter-day Saint theology and Latter-day Saint culture. Historically, they've always been tightly intertwined.
Yeah.
But, you know, Berkeley, I think, is exhibit one in the ways that some Latter-day Saints, especially on the left, but not always, are finding ways to embrace Latter-day Saint culture without necessarily following the letter of the law,
yeah.
or certainly the spirit of the law, rather, you know, from the top. You know, and as someone who is culturally Jewish, but not religiously so, you know, I know within my culture it is possible to be a Jewish atheist, as I am. Mm-hmm. And that's not a contradiction in terms in my culture.
Right.
I identify as fully Jewish and very much not a believer in God, at least in the ways that I think traditional religions would conceive of that. And I wonder whether, you know, Mormonism as an ethno-religion, in the same way that Judaism is a possible future, whether it's possible that a group of people who say, I am Mormon, but I do not follow, you know, this current president, whether that might be one direction that a segment of the Latter-day Saint community might be going in.
Emily Kaplan, her piece is The Rise of Liberal Latter-day Saints. It appears in the Washington Post magazine. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER is your source for trustworthy news and information. But if you need a break from the news, try Classical KUER. It's our live 24/7 classical music stream curated by knowledgeable and engaging hosts. Whether you're new to classical music or an aficionado, there's something for everyone on Classical KUER. Listen on the KUER mobile app and at classicalkuer.org.
This is Radio Westenberg for Brizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Emily Kaplan's article in the Washington Post magazine about this moment for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the growth of progressive Mormons, but also very conservative Mormons, and how that's raising questions about the future of Mormonism. This week, we reached out to Patrick Mason. He teaches religious studies at Utah State University, and we asked him, is this moment an inflection point for the church?
Well, I think it's complicated. I think the answer is yes and no. In some ways, you could always say that there's always an inflection point in the sense that people can always make choices, leaders can always make choices to go in different directions. And what can seem in the moment like an inflection point can, in retrospect, not be one. And the opposite can be true as well. So it's a little bit hard to tell when you're living right in the middle of the moment, whether in fact it will be. I do tend to think that there are some internal and external stresses on the church right now that need some resolution. So those stresses may force leaders and members to make some decisions that we look back on and say, yeah, that was an inflection point for the church.
Yeah. You know, usually this conversation, or very often this conversation, is about how progressive Latter-day Saints have tried to find a way to, you know, reconcile their ideals, their lives with, you know, a conservative church and its conservative leaders.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about Kaplan's article is it's starting to raise the question for conservatives, you know, whether you now have conservative people, very conservative Latter-day Saints, who are trying to reconcile their ideas with leaders they don't think are maybe conservative enough. Do you think that's right? Is this a new twist we're seeing?
I think it is a new twist. And it's, you know, liberals within the church started to figure this stuff out back in the 1960s. Largely around issues of race and gender within the church, where, you know, they disagreed with church leaders, but had sufficient loyalty and found enough meaning in the church that they stuck with it, stuck with the institution, even in their personal disagreements. And of course, a lot of conservatives in the church have been wagging their fingers at liberals for the past half century, saying you can't do that. And now we see the tables turned. I think it is not just this exact moment that we're in. I started to see this with the November 2015 policy especially around baptism of children. And I talked to a lot of people, longtime faithful members of the church, who this policy affected their own grandchildren. And I had people tell me, for the first time in my life, I seriously disagree with the prophet or with the brethren. And those were people kind of in the middle or in the center right. Now, of course, with around masks and vaccinations, we're seeing this more from people further to the right. So I think now, you know, everybody is in the same boat, whether you're liberals or conservatives in the church, and they're all wrestling with this question of what it means to sometimes disagree with its leaders.
Kaplan mentions in her piece, you know, how conservatives are facing a similar kind of cognitive dissonance that, as you mentioned, you know, liberals have been dealing with for a long time. So when progressive Latter-day Saints, like Lisa Mosman, when she told Emily Kaplan that conservatives are asking themselves these days who they trust more, you know, President Nelson or Tucker Carlson. Is that right? And does that get to this to a maybe a unique moment where now people on the right, their political ideology is becoming as important or maybe even more important to them than their religious connections to the church?
I think that's true to an extent. I'm not sure that I would characterize it quite so starkly as a competition of personalities. You know, President Nelson versus Tucker Carlson or Donald Trump, or I'm not sure that it could be distilled quite that, you know, with quite that pure of an essence. But the broader point I think is absolutely true, and there's a lot of social scientific research to back this up. That it used to be that if you told me what your religion was, I could guess, at least with a high degree of accuracy, not perfect accuracy, but I could guess how that would translate into various positions in the public square. Now it's the opposite, that it does seem that politics is increasingly a driver of religious ideology and religious affiliation or lack thereof. And in a lot of ways, I mean, I see this both as a religion scholar and as somebody who's religious myself. I see this as, you know, the religion isn't doing its job in the sense of sufficiently forming people's moral and ethical worldviews. And so when religion is held captive to political ideologies and other kinds of things, that to me is a sign that religion is not sufficiently strong to do what it at least says it's meant to do.
So who are they competing against? Is it the information age, digital technology, social media? That's what's driving this. That's what's fueling this. And religious leaders haven't come up with a response, a counter to that yet?
I think so. I mean, I've heard a number of different religious leaders, especially evangelicals and others, make the point, and I think it's a sound one, and they say, look, we get people in the pews if we're lucky. I mean, of course, we now know that church attendance in the United States is under 50%. So if we're lucky, we get people in the pews, we get their attention for 1 or 2 hours a week. But between social media, Fox News, MSNBC, whatever their information sources are or disinformation sources are, they're getting that nonstop, almost 24/7. And so, how in the world can the church, whether you're evangelical, Catholic, Latter-day Saint, whatever, how you just can't compete in terms of the volume of material that people are consuming, either actively or passively? The percentage of it that's coming from the churches is pretty small. So for them, they say it's a question of moral formation. It's a question of spiritual formation. And in general, again, the churches just aren't keeping up.
I wanted to get your reaction to one of the themes in the Washington Post article that some Mormons are now using, you know, that really unique feature of the faith, personal revelation, as a kind of I mean, this is my term, not Emily Kaplan's, but as a kind of workaround in the parts of doctrines or positions taken by leaders that people don't agree with on the right and the left. Do you think that's right? Is this, or have people always used that as a kind of way to get around it?
Well, I think it's always been true to a certain extent. I mean, you go back to the 1850s, for instance, and Orson Pratt severely disagreed with Brigham Young on when it came to Brigham Young's teachings about race. And he did so publicly, and he did so based on his own reading of the scriptures and his own. He probably didn't use the phrase personal revelation. That's kind of more of a contemporary phrase, but certainly his own sensibilities. He was willing to publicly disagree with Brigham Young, but without breaking from the church. So this is not a new thing, but I do think you're exactly right that we see it on both sides. So on the left, for instance, among progressives, and let's take the instance of LGBTQ members, a lot of people would say, hey, I have received personal revelation where God tells me I'm fine just the way I am, that I don't need to change anything, that my sexuality is a part of my divine identity as a son or a daughter of God, and so I'm fine. and I'm just waiting for the church to get on board with the revelation that God's already given me. And then, of course, people on the other side, you know, say, you know, I've received revelation that that I shouldn't receive vaccines, that or that I shouldn't give these vaccines to my children, that these are dangerous, or it's a sign of government overreach, it's a sign of tyranny, or socialism, or something like that. It's a sign of the times, and so nothing that any leader can tell me can override my own personal revelation from God. And I think we saw that too in instances like the Bundys and other things like that. So this is not new, but it seems to have a certain kind of potency right now, maybe that we haven't seen in the past.
So let's take that segment then from the right, the conservative segment you mentioned there, because it does seem like there is a growing faction of Mormon conservatives, those who align with the kind of Donald Trump wing of the Republican Party. Some are given to believe in, you know, QAnon or election fraud conspiracies. And it's kind of like a new type of maybe potential dissident group within the faith. And I wonder, who should church leaders worry about more, this brand of conservatives, or should they be more concerned at the push and pull that comes from liberals on the left who are challenging the church on, you know, gay rights and women's rights and other issues?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, probably most church leaders, because most of them are going to be center right. So the people on the far left, if we can characterize it that way, seem further away. So they seem like more of a threat. They always have. But actually, I think if you're, you know, the overall message of church leaders in recent years and recent general conferences, I think they really want to hold the center. Now, again, for them, their vision of the center is center right compared to the rest of the culture. But they want to hold the center. I think they genuinely see what they would characterize as extremes on both sides as dangerous. So I don't think they want to throw in their lot, you know, with the extreme right any more than they do with the extreme left. I think they genuinely see dangers on both sides.
You told Emily Kaplan that you could see multiple futures of Mormonism. And I wondered if you could maybe take me through a few of the possibilities that are possibly there. I mean, she brings up the issue of our conversation with her. Emily brought up the issue of whether more and more people, millennials, for example, maybe others are going to untether from the church in a way that's unusual for, you know, centralized Mormonism. There are a lot. She mentioned it's a lot like cafeteria Catholics or Jews like Kaplan herself, who are not really observant but still affiliate with the faith in a kind of cultural, traditional way. I wonder, is that one of these multiple futures, one of the elements here that you're seeing?
I think it certainly is. And I think to some degree that kind of pattern is probably inevitable no matter what, as the church grows and matures, as it becomes over time, it's become less sectarian, and as it becomes more like a denomination within the American landscape and less like a sect or a distinct subculture like we saw in the pioneer area, you know, really up until the mid-20th century, we'll just see more and more of that. People who see it as a kind of heritage, a part of their heritage, rather than an active part of their religious identity. But I can see a number of different futures. I think, you know, maybe ranking them from what I see as most likely to least likely. I think the most likely is that the church continues more or less as it is. It tries to hold the center together. It basically remains a center-right denomination within, you know, the American religious landscape. Continues to focus on global growth, and that growth and kind of temple work, the kind of core religious mission of the church, that is the priority, and they don't want to do anything to jeopardize that on the left or the right or anything. So they want to kind of hold to the center. I think that's the most likely outcome. I think another outcome is that the church leaders make the decision to actually double down on some of these conservative and traditional positions. And they do something like what the Southern Baptist Convention did in the 1980s when it went to the right and it became more of a fundamentalist denomination. They didn't necessarily have to excommunicate or purge all the liberals. They just created a place where those liberals felt uncomfortable and they left on their own. And so the entire denomination within the space of a few years became a much more conservative place, kind of place where Jimmy Carter no longer felt comfortable. And then I think the least likely scenario is that new revelation comes and the church announces we're going to ordain women, or we're going to in some ways honor same-sex marriage, all the way up until to sealing same-sex couples. That seems almost unthinkable. But there have been a lot of things in the 200 years of church history that have seemed unthinkable until it happened. And so I think that is in a church that says it has living prophets and continuous revelation. I wouldn't take anything off the table, even if it's not particularly likely.
So in all of those scenarios, the way you're ranking them, what it sounds like seems most likely, at least to your way of thinking, is that the church is going to probably choose... Well, stay as it is, you said, but if it's going to make a choice between members who are on the fringe on the right or members who are on the fringe of the left, they'll opt for the base, those on the right. Or is that oversimplifying what you just said?
Well, I think they would say we don't want the fringes on either side. But I do think they would say, yeah, we want the base, and the base is a center right church, which if American culture continues to move in more progressive directions, and that's an open question, then the center right looks further and further to the right itself. But the church doesn't want to go in the direction of the Bundys. It doesn't want to go in the direction of QAnon, but it definitely doesn't right now want to go in the direction of progressivism either. So it wants to try to steer that middle course. I also think that, you know, as central and essential as the American church is, I actually really think that a lot of the calculations that church leaders are making are in an effort to foster growth and the success of the church around the world, and I think they don't want the global church to be held captive by American cultural politics, and so that they may be willing, and so probably what that means is that they may be willing to leave behind some of the people on the far left in order to capture a kind of global membership, which generally tends to be more conservative and more traditional, especially around gender and sexuality issues.
You say in the Washington Post piece that you don't know which way all of this will go. What should we be looking for then in the coming years that might provide some clues?
I think the clues will be... So for instance, I thought this most recent General Conference was a clue in the sense that they want to continue to hold a kind of center-right position. There was no talk of LGBTQ issues. I mean, it was almost, who knows how these things actually happen, but it seems like there was a memo that went out that says, we're not going to talk about controversial stuff. We're just going to focus on Jesus. And it was a kind of an olive leaf type of General Conference where they didn't want to engage in the culture wars. So I think one of the clues to look at is in those kinds of settings. Of course, just a few weeks before that, we had Elder Holland down at BYU talking about muskets and things like that. So there always are mixed messages. But what seems to be the dominant theme? Does it seem to be a conciliatory kind of irenic theme, especially in their kind of public posture? Or are they adopting more of a kind of culture warrior posture, as we've seen in other general conferences? So long as that kind of conciliatory, irenic posture remains a dominant, if not exclusive, mode, then I think that's a pretty good clue that the church will continue on its more centrist path.
Patrick Mason, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks, Doug.
Patrick Mason, he's an associate professor of religious studies and history at Utah State University. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter @Radio West. Our intern is Stu Nolan. The program is produced by Carrie Watson, by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.